Pakistani government to send a letter to the American government asking for an independent medical evaluation of Afia
Stephen
to make
Downs,
sure that she's alive and in good health.
We have to wrap,
and
but we're going to continue this interview.
The idea of somehow
we're
repatriating Afia to Pakistan, where she really belongs.
I want to thank you for being with us, and we're going to continue this interview to explain her case and post it online at democracynow.org. Stephen Downs, Lyric R. Cabral, and David Felix Sutcliffe, thank you so much for being with us. Their film is Terror. You should see it. And Marlene, thank you so much for being with us, mother of Tariq Shah. I'm Amy Goodman. This is democracynow.org.
The Creative Music Guild, Merrillhurst University, and KBOO Community Radio are proud sponsors of a weekend residency by Mark Rabeau, May 8th and 9th at Merrillhurst University. Renowned guitarist and composer Mark Rabeau will perform a solo concert on Friday, May 8th at 8 p.m. and will lead a workshop on group free improvisation on Saturday, May 9th from 2 to 5. The workshop is open to musicians of any experience level, and all instruments are welcome. Both events are taking place at the St. Anne's Church on the Merrillhurst campus, 17600 Pacific Highway, which is Highway 43. More information about the May 8th and 9th events featuring Mark Rabeau can be found on kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Sex Workers film series hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, the film A Kiss for Gabriella will be shown Tuesday, April 21st at 7 p.m. Gabriella Lita is the first sex worker to run for Brazilian Congress. A Kiss for Gabriella tells the story of her 2010 campaign as she faces 822 opponents and challenges a male-dominated political system to see if a sex worker, activist, wife, mother, and cultural icon can beat the odds and win the election. Again, that's A Kiss for Gabriella, Tuesday, April 21st at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News, so stay tuned.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, today marks the fifth anniversary of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
The Oregon Senate passed a bill that would allow defendants to testify in grand juries.
And police in London cracked down on marijuana smokers celebrating today, 420.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 20th, 2015. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Eric Tegedoff. Today is April 20th, known among cannabis enthusiasts as 420. Traditionally, the day is marked by large gatherings to celebrate the marijuana plant and smoke it. Today's London gathering of around 10,000 people was met by a large police presence, and around 50 people were hauled away in handcuffs. In Salem, Oregon this morning, a march in support of Oregon's medical marijuana program took place at 11 a.m. at the state capitol. The organizers of the event say they are worried that the legalization of marijuana in Oregon, which will take place this summer, will have an adverse effect on the medical marijuana program. No arrests have been reported from that event.
A bill passed in the Oregon Senate today will allow defendants to testify in grand juries. Civil liberties advocates have long called for reform of Oregon's grand jury system, which has a history of having more than 90% of civilian defendants sent to trial, and over 99% of police defendants acquitted. Grand juries are required in Oregon every time someone is charged with a felony. They are supposed to be used to determine if a case should go forward to a trial, but opponents point out that the grand jury system, as it's set up, is flawed to prejudice the jury against the defendant. Most of the time, the defendants are unable to attend, even hear, let alone respond to, the charges against them. Police officers who face charges are allowed to attend and to defend themselves. Today's bill, if it passes the House and is signed by the governor, would allow defendants to request to testify at their own grand jury hearing. Here's a clip from the Senate floor today.
This bill, if it becomes law, will give the suspect of a grand jury proceeding the right to testify before the grand jury if they choose. This right to testify is limited to those suspects who have already been arrested on charges that are the subject of grand jury proceedings to occur in the future. It does not apply to grand jury proceedings that are secret, where the suspect has not been arrested on charges and may not even know that charges are being considered. If the suspect chooses to testify before the grand jury, they are first sworn under oath and then are allowed to present their side of the story of a criminal allegation. Now, some would ask, why would anybody want to do that? Well, it can be very helpful to a grand jury in deciding whether or not a crime has actually occurred, especially when it comes to cases like self-defense or defense of property, where the issue is what the suspect saw, heard, what their experience, and if they had a reasonable, justified belief that defense was necessary. It can also be important when the factual scenario of a crime is complicated and needs explaining. Now, giving the right to a suspect to testify has been recognized as a necessary grand jury reform by organizations of all kinds of public or political persuasions, including the American Bar Association, the National Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, as well as the Heritage Foundation. It is seen as something that creates balance and fairness to grand jury proceedings, which otherwise only hears from the government attorneys and the witnesses the government chooses to present. Testimony on this bill shows that in Oregon, district attorneys usually allow or agree to let the suspect testify when they ask, but not always. In some instances, district attorneys reject the offer. Senate Bill 825 would standardize the practice, giving more consistent application of this right around the state. I urge your aye vote.
Senator Betsy Johnson, please.
Thank you. To the bill?
To the bill, please.
This bill strikes me as a solution in search of a problem. Defendants don't have the right to testify at grand jury proceedings. This is not a trial. It is not a finding of truth. It is a screening process. This bill seems to subvert the whole concept that we pick seven people, good and true, who own the grand jury process, not the courts, not the DAs, but the grand jurors, and this bill now directs them who they have to hear from. In the experience of one of the DAs in my district that I consulted, there are many times that grand jurors don't want to hear from suspects, and the idea that they can be compelled to hear witnesses that they don't wish brought before them is a fundamental violation of the whole concept of grand jury independence. Also, in real life, in the highly unlikely event that a defense attorney would want their client to testify, they already can communicate that to the district attorney, and the DAs almost invariably offer the grand jury the opportunity to hear the defendant slash suspect. I would urge a no vote on this bill.
Further discussion of the measure, I recognize Senator Alan Olson, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Will the carrier entertain a question, please?
Will the carrier yield to a question?
Sure.
She will.
Thank you. When the defendant goes in, will he be Mirandized?
They are sworn in, and yes, they would be subject to prosecution to perjury if it was later proven. I don't know Mirandized, but they would.
Yeah, that's a Miranda rights, whether
yeah,
they
yeah,
can.
Yeah, no, but.
All right.
I don't
thank
think
you to
that
the bill,
okay.
Mr. President.
Excuse me. Are you through your question?
Yes.
Please, to the bill.
Colleagues, once again, it's as the good senator from Senate District 16 said, it's kind of amazing that a defendant would want to go in and testify before a grand jury, because if they gave testimony that could impeach their truth and indicate that they are guilty, it would be very difficult for them to get out of it afterwards. So I will also be a no on this bill.
Senator Thatcher, you're closing.
Yes, please. Just a couple things. These suspects would be represented by counsel. Counsel knows full well what they would be facing and whether it would be a good idea and advisable for them to be being directly cross-examined by these grand jury members or the DA. I mean, there's a lot at risk here potentially. So there would be very narrow circumstances, as was stated before, where this would apply. And in these cases, it's very important for the you know, especially in cases of self-defense and defense of property, that they understand what the situation was, so that they can determine whether a crime had actually taken place at the time. And though district attorneys often agree, usually agree here in Oregon, this ability to explain oneself has been rejected. And this would just standardize the practice, as I said, and make it a little more consistent application of this practice. And I urge your aye vote. Thank you.
The bill allowing defendants to attend their grand jury hearings in Oregon passed the Senate and now moves to the Oregon House for approval. University of Oregon's head of special collections, James Fox, will not have his contract renewed this June after several years working in the university's library. His release this summer is in part due to the release of 25,000 pages of university presidential records to economics professor Bill Harbaugh. Professor Harbaugh is a thorn in the side of the administration and asked for the documents in order to expose the president's so-called, quote, obsessive secrecy, unquote. Although Harbaugh eventually gave back the documents before any supposedly damaging information about students or faculty was disclosed, James Fox is now taking the fall. KBOO reporter Eric Tegedoff spoke with James Fox about the release of these documents and the termination of his contract this summer.
To be honest with you, I'm not quite sure what the reasons are, and they seem to be changing the story.
Well, it seems like part of it might have to do with the release of about 25,000 documents to Professor Harbaugh. And I think the university said that you needed to vet these documents before you release them. My question is, how long would it take to have vetted all of those papers that came from the president?
You can imagine it's going to take hundreds and hundreds of work hours to do that. For the university president's office to essentially pass that responsibility onto the University of Oregon Library, and I want to emphasize the University of Oregon Library, not Special Collections and University Archives, but the University of Oregon Library, without really defining the mission, I mean, how were we supposed to vet them? What are the guidelines? There's nothing in statute in Oregon law about how university presidents' papers are to be reviewed and vetted. So that means that the institution has to develop those standards and guidelines. And the University of Oregon president's office did nothing to work with the library to define what those guidelines were or could be. And secondly, once those papers were given over to the library, apparently there was never any provisions about who would do that and where that staffing would come. We know from a 2013 report done by a group of independent consultants, they came to the library and said that record management was misplaced in the library. The library did not have the resources to vet all of those records. So, and that came in 2013. That report went to the dean of the libraries and on to the provost. So the university was well advised that it was beyond the capabilities of the library to vet records, that volume of records, and the university did nothing to address the problem.
Are there any resources now to help vet documents like this or future releases like this?
Well, that's a very interesting question. After the release, the university has gone and hired a team of people to go through those records. But that's sort of like, you know, closing the barn door after the horses have gotten out. I've been telling the deans of the library and the dean, to her credit, Dean Adrian Lim, had been telling the central administration that we had a problem with records management. She'd been telling them that since September and October of 2014, and she told me that they were dragging their heels in addressing that problem. So the university, the Johnson Hall, where the administration is housed, they knew about the problem, and that it was way beyond the capacity of the library to review those records.
So it sounds like they might have a team now. Do you think there's going to be any repercussions for future release of information?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I had been warning the university, the library administration, that records management was a disaster waiting to happen. I said repeatedly that records management is about risk management. And if you're not managing your records, you're not managing risk to the university. But apparently, until now, really managing the records of the university wasn't a high priority. It is now. And this is true at every university and college across the country. University administrations don't pay attention to records management until there's a serious situation or a disaster. The fortunate thing in the University of Oregon's case, as far as I can tell, and I have not been privy to all the information because I've been locked out of my office, locked out of email, I've been locked out of communication, this was a relatively minor breach. All of the records were returned. No confidential information. Maybe one document could potentially be confidential, was released out into the internet. So the privacy of people were protected. The researcher who requested these documents was required to sign a statement saying that if he found confidential or private information, he was prohibited by law from releasing it or using it, and he was to alert our staff and to return those materials. That's standard across the country. And he did return those. So we had put in safeguards, knowing that we could not look into every single document to find potentially confidential materials.
Well, thank you very much for that.
All right. Well, it was my pleasure. I appreciate your interest in this story. And
absolutely.
Once again, I think what we want to find is not more adversarial relationships and contention, but we want to find solutions.
That was James Fox, the University of Oregon's head of Special Collections and University Archives. For KBOO News, I'm Eric Tegedoff. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, followed by Labor Radio on at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight, Sarah Vitak interviews Romeo Sosa, the executive director of VOLS, a workers' rights education project based in Portland, and Jonathan Irwin, former volunteer with No Más Muertes, No More Deaths, in Tucson, Arizona. They'll discuss the incarceration and deportation of undocumented immigrants and the collaborations between immigration and customs enforcement and the Portland Police Bureau. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow, say goodbye to the warm weather. There is a 20% chance of rain, and the high will be 67, the low 46. Today in history, in 1871, Congress authorized President Ulysses S. Grant to declare martial law, impose heavy penalties against terrorist groups, and use military force to suppress the Ku Klux Klan. In 1914, the Colorado National Guard and Colorado Fire and Iron Company fired on striking coal miners and their families in Ludlow, Colorado. At least 17 people, including women and children, were killed in the massacre. The quote of the day is a popular phrase soldiers used in World War II when it was time for a break. Smoke 'em if you got 'em.
Today marks the 5-year anniversary of the BP Deepwater Horizon oil well blowout and spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The oil spill killed 11 employees working on the oil platform and caused almost 5 million barrels of oil to flow into the Gulf of Mexico. BP also sprayed almost 2 million gallons of the oil dispersing chemical called Corexit into the Gulf in an attempt to disperse the oil. This well blowout and spill lasted for almost 3 months before the well cap was sealed on September 19th in 2010. Many environmental experts believe the well is still leaking small amounts of oil daily. 33,000 workers helped in the cleanup in the days and months after the oil well blowout occurred. Their health will be monitored for 10 years to measure any ill effects exposure to the oil or chemical Corexit may cause. While BP has paid out billions in cleanup fees, a federal judge this year found the company liable for up to $18 billion more in fines for violation of the Clean Water Act. The federal judge found BP to be guilty of gross negligence and willful misconduct. BP appealed the decision, and a final ruling is expected this summer, Until then, communities continue to wait for the billions BP promised them to help them recover from the effects of the oil spill. Less than 25% of the oil was recovered, and tar balls wash up daily on beaches along the Gulf Coast from Texas to Florida. Last month, a 25,000-pound tar mat was found on East Gran Terra Island, located about 100 miles due south of New Orleans. And other environmental effects are showing up in the Gulf of Mexico as well. Barrier islands made up of mangrove trees are disappearing at a rapidly increasing rate around the region. The barrier islands are made up largely of mangrove roots collecting sand and making a small island. As the mangrove root systems were inundated with oil during the spill, it smothered the root system, killing the mangrove trees. As the trees died and washed away, nothing was left to hold the sand in place, and the barrier islands disappear. One island called Cat Island was considered to be the fourth largest breeding ground and rookery in the Gulf of Mexico. It is now gone, leaving numerous protected and endangered species of birds with nowhere to nest in order to breed and raise their young.
To mark the occasion of the fifth anniversary of the largest marine oil spill in history, members of affected Gulf Coast communities gathered outside of the BP offices in Houston today. The organizers of the event called for restoration, as well as reaffirming the shared struggle of Gulf Coast communities to move forward. FSRN's Shannon Young spoke with Jayesha Duda, coordinator of the Gulf Future Coalition, for more on the environmental justice movement emerging in the Gulf Coast states.
Jayesha Duda, you are in Houston today, 5 years since the start of the BP oil spill disaster. How did you and other Gulf Coast residents mark the occasion?
We had a interfaith memorial service and jazz funeral today at the BP headquarters. We had fishermen from Galveston and Mississippi here. We had folks from Mobile, Alabama. We had folks from all over Louisiana. Houston folks, are really people from all across the Gulf Coast. We even had some people from North Carolina and Appalachia and Wyoming and California to be with us today and tell BP that things are not right. And 5 years later, we still suffer lots of harm and economic losses, environmental losses, community losses, health. You know, people are dying, continuing to die. So we wanted to mark the occasion with a pretty solemn affair, but also something that would unite us, bring us together as a community, because we know that, you know, together we're strong and we're powerful. And we know that, you know, if enough of us continue to come together in ways that build power, we can fight these corporations.
Today's events in Houston are part of a larger context of actions carried out in the run-up to the anniversary. What else has been happening in other Gulf Coast communities?
Yeah, this is part of a week of action starting. It started on April 15th in solidarity with the Fight for 15. We see economic justice issues as essentially interwoven with the issues that we're talking about when we talk about the BP oil disaster. We've had throughout the week events across all five Gulf Coast states. In particular, there's been a series of boat trips that led by Tao Vu from the Mississippi Coalition of Vietnamese American Fisher Folks and Families. And she has been bringing decision makers and media out on boats into the water to see for themselves firsthand the impact of the oil disaster and how the fisheries are collapsing and how these folks who are completely dependent on the waters are finding that they are not bringing in the same number of crabs and oysters and fish as they did prior to April 20th, 2010. We've also had Family Fest happened in Mason Park here in Houston. We wanted to have an event to really bring together family that, you know, maybe wouldn't be able to take off a day of work or school to be with us today over the weekend. And Cry You One is a performance that comes out of Southeast Louisiana. A couple of New Orleans theater groups that are part of the Gulf Future Coalition put on a full-scale performance in Mason Park. And so that performative aspect and then kind of the arts-based aspect is also part of our week of action. So we're really trying to see action as being, you know, not just things like rallies, but also things like bringing community together, experiencing art that is trying to say something about the conditions that we live in. And so really bringing together community through a variety of means. And so this week of action, we've really tried to highlight that. But there's a lot of different ways that folks can engage and rise up. And that's one of the big central messages of the Gulf South Rising movement initiative that we are launching this week. And it goes from now until the end of the year, in particular with the 10-year observance of Katrina and Rita in August and September. We really see this movement work continuing, and we hope to bring a delegation of Gulf South residents and citizens and tribal members to the climate negotiations in Paris at the end of the year. So it's kind of, this is the beginning of a trajectory of movement building, and we're looking forward to that continuing from now until the end of the year.
One of the stated goals of the Gulf South Rising movement is to shift the narrative away from one of resilience to one of resistance. Can you explain a bit more about why?
Yeah, I mean, the term resilience is one of those terms that has really, we feel, been overused. And at this point, particularly in this region where folks are still recovering from Katrina, from Rita, from Isaac, from the BP oil disaster, the term is being now used by decision makers and corporate criminals to say, well, you know, whatever happens, they'll come back up. We can just continue to push on them and extract from them and not do right by them because they're resilient. And what we want to say is that as a region, we are resistant. We are not going to take that kind of treatment anymore. We're not going to accept the fact that the resources that need to be invested in our region are, you know, not being invested because we're resilient. That's not okay. We need to see significant infrastructure. We need to see the East Coast, the West Coast, the, you know, Midwest, the other parts of this country that benefit from all the resources of this region. They need to start realizing that if they don't shift their ways, we are going to continue to suffer things like the BP oil disaster, the impacts of climate change, the land sinking in Louisiana. So we really want to say our resistance movement is about not only for us to say no to the corporations and to the folks who are extracting from us, but also to, you know, resist this narrative that has emerged that resilient communities can take anything. And it's like, yes, we are strong, but we are resistant. Resilience is not a term to be used for us to be exploited. We are rising up, we are fighting back, and we are ready to build a movement here that is rooted in, you know, the longest legacy of movement building in this country comes out of the South. And so we really want to honor that legacy and continue that fight that has really never ended.
That was Jaisha Dutta of the New Orleans-based Gulf Future Coalition. She joined us by phone from Houston, Texas. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
The Texas House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved a bill on Friday that would gut the power of municipalities to pass anti-fracking rules, angering environmentalists and cities across the state. Conservative state lawmakers have been working to stop a growing anti-fracking movement since last November when voters in the town of Denton passed the nation's first ever municipal ban on fracking. Denton is the birthplace of the fracking industry. Fracking refers to hydraulic fracturing, which is a process used in natural gas and other resource extraction in which high volumes of chemicals and water are sprayed deep underground. The practice destabilizes water sources and has been proven to cause earthquake swarms. Texas House approved the bill on the second anniversary of the explosion of a fertilizer plant in West Texas, which claimed 15 lives. Texas environmental groups said today that the tragedy in West Texas showed the need for stronger safety protections on hazardous facilities, but instead the House is moving in the opposite direction. The Texas Oil and Gas Association, in a YouTube video released last month, argued against municipal control, saying, quote, "The state is in the best position to ensure public safety," unquote. But according to data from the National Institute on Money in State Politics, the three elected commissioners of the Texas Railroad Commission, which regulates oil and gas, accepted more than $2 million in campaign contributions from the industry during the 2012 election cycle. The industry donated more than $5 million to Texas legislators during 2013 and 2014, according to a Texans for Public Justice report. The average House member pocketed more than $25,000. The Texas bill to stop municipalities like Denton from banning fracking passed overwhelmingly in the House, with 30 of the 52 Democrats in the House supporting the bill. Before it becomes law, the bill will also need to be passed by the state Senate and signed by the governor. Denton activists have vowed to continue their fight against fracking, no matter how the Texas legislature votes.
The lead investigator into the 2001 anthrax attacks has filed a federal whistleblower lawsuit against the FBI earlier this month. The whistleblower suit claims the FBI withheld evidence that established the innocence of Dr. Bruce Ivins, the man that the FBI claimed mailed the anthrax. Richard Lambert, a senior FBI agent and 24-year veteran of the agency, filed the lawsuit in federal court on April 2nd of this year. The agent claims the FBI systematically and persistently understaffed the anthrax investigation, used inexperienced agents, and walled off the investigation of exculpatory evidence. Shortly after the September 11th attacks, several letters containing weaponized anthrax were mailed to two Democratic senators and several members of the press. Both Democratic senators who were mailed the anthrax letters had publicly come out in opposition to the Anti-Terrorism Patriot Act that was coming up for a vote. Shortly after receiving the anthrax letters, both senators voted in favor of the Patriot Act. Subsequent investigations found that the anthrax had been developed by the United States Army. The FBI claimed that Bruce Ivins was a chief suspect in the anthrax attacks. Ivins, a senior biodefense researcher with 18 years of experience at the Fort Detrick Army Base in the bioweapons lab, was placed under FBI surveillance and investigation. Ivins later committed suicide in 2008. No autopsy was performed and no suicide note was ever found. Prior to the FBI fingering Dr. Ivins, the FBI had accused another senior Army bioweapons researcher, Stephen Hatfield, of the crime. Hatfield sued the FBI and won a $4.6 million defamation suit against the agency. The anthrax letter attacks killed 5 people and injured 17 others.
Walmart closed 5 stores nationwide last week in an effort to combat what the retail giant called multiple plumbing problems. Employees at the stores that closed last week filed suit today with the National Labor Relations Board, claiming that Walmart closed the stores in retaliation to worker demands for higher wages and better working conditions. The suit filed by the Walmart employees with the National Labor Relations Board claims that Walmart engaged in illegal and unfair labor practices and that the plumbing problems were not the cause of the closings. Stores were closed in Florida, Texas, Oklahoma, and California, but no plumbing permits were applied for, leading employees to claim that plumbing issues were not the problem and charged the company with unfair and illegal labor practices. The California store was the site of the first major Walmart store to strike in 2012 and has been at the forefront of the Walmart employee protests since then. While Walmart recently raised the minimum wage for employees up to $9 an hour, analysts have shown that Walmart is paying for the wage increase by demanding lower prices from suppliers. Demanding lower prices from suppliers puts pressure on the suppliers to cut costs, who then cut wages for their employees. The Walmart stores closed with only a few hours of notice to the employees.
It's 5:32, and you know what that means. It's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
So someone hands you a beer, but instead of it being a recognizable brand, it's in a totally blacked out can with nothing but the letters TPP printed on it. "You're really gonna like this," says the smiling stranger who handed it to you. But you naturally hesitate and ask, "Well, who made it? What's in it?" Now the guy's smile seems forced as he says, "Sorry, pal, but those are trade secrets. Trust me, though, there's nothing bad in it. Just drink up and enjoy the buzz that it's going to give you." Would you swallow that? Neither would I. But here comes Barack Obama, Senator Mitch McConnell, Speaker John Boehner, and every corporate lobbyist in Washington insisting that we the people should quickly chug-a-lug their strange brew called TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, without knowing what's in it. "It's just a free trade agreement," they say, with lying eyes and forced smiles. But TPP is not free, not about trade, and not anything that we normal Americans would ever agree to. Rather, it's a raw deal enthroning global corporations over our democratic right to be a self-governing people. It creates a whole new privatized government, subjecting us and our laws to an overriding supreme authority of corporate tribunals set up by the World Bank and the UN. TPP literally is an un-American sneak attack on us by our own leaders. Negotiated in strict secrecy by a handful of corporate elites and government officials, they produced a secret deal that is to be kept secret from the people for 4 years after it is approved, even though it transfers much of our people's sovereignty to secretive international tribunals made up of global corporate lawyers with no accountability to the people. This is Jim Hightower saying, Holy Thomas Paine! To fight this establishment of secret government, go to www.stoptpp.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Leader of the UK's Independent Party, Nigel Farage, says that the NATO bombing of Libya is to blame for the recent drowning of hundreds of migrants in the Mediterranean. In the past week, two boats have capsized heading from Libya's coast to Italy. The first boat contained about 550 people, of which nearly 400 drowned, and the second contained about 950 people. Farage said the NATO bombing to rid Libya of Gaddafi ultimately destabilized the country and turned it, quote, into a country of much savagery and a place where, for Christians, the situation is virtually impossible, unquote. Other independent party members in the UK have pointed to the tragedies as an excuse to leave the European Union. But the UN High Commissioner for Refugees said that the anti-immigration rhetoric across the EU has blocked efforts to create search and rescue missions in the Mediterranean. Foreign ministers in the EU will meet today to discuss the crisis. Through statements from the EU are centered mostly on Libyan traffickers and not their own efforts to stop future tragedies.
A Saudi-led coalition airstrike in the capital of Yemen may have killed dozens of civilians this morning. One of the bombs in the airstrikes is alleged to have hit a munitions cache in the area, causing an explosion which flattened homes in the area. The Saudi-led coalition is estimated to have killed hundreds of civilians since it began its bombing campaign 3 weeks ago against northern Houthi rebels in Yemen. Witnesses and aid workers say airstrikes have hit gas stations, residential neighborhoods, and, in one case, a storage facility for the relief organization Oxfam. In a statement yesterday, Oxfam said that the bombing was, quote, an absolute outrage, particularly when one considers that we have shared detailed information with the coalition on the location of our offices and storage facilities, unquote. Human rights workers say some of the strikes may amount to war crimes if civilians were deliberately targeted, or if the coalition failed to distinguish between civilians and combatants. The Obama administration is supporting the Saudi-led coalition bombings by providing them with intelligence and logistical assistance.
300 American Army paratroopers arrived in western Ukraine last Friday to help train Ukrainian National Guard units. The troops were deployed for an initial six-month period, along with $75 million worth of non-lethal military supplies, including over 200 armored Humvees. Russian military leaders called the American troop presence destabilizing. Sporadic fighting has occurred since the February ceasefire was signed by the American-backed Ukrainian government and the pro-Russian rebel troops. Over 6,000 people have been killed in the Ukrainian civil war over the last year. Most observers expect the ceasefire to fail as the eastern Ukrainian rebels have stuck to their demand for a self-governed autonomous region in eastern Ukraine. The Ukrainian government has called the proposal a non-starter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 501-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ken Yashikawa and Don Zur. The producer is me, Eric Tegedoff. Special thanks to Paul Roland. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503
503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. If you want to reach the mayor, Charlie Hales, he can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philamath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Emily Young. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 9 on Alternative Radio, Robert Fisk, journalist and author, and Araxi Barsamyan, survivor of the Turkish genocide of the Armenians, speak on the Armenian Holocaust. The special program marks the centenary of the Armenian genocide, April 24th, 1915, Armenian Martyrs Day. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Dime Roberts speaks with Sandy Tolan, author of Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land, about his new book, Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land. At 11:30 on Art Focused, host Joseph Gallivan speaks with Zemi Barr, exhibitions manager at Blue Sky Gallery, the Oregon Center for the Photographic Arts, about their yearly juried show in which all the photographs are displayed in drawers. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And now stay tuned for a look at the effects of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Hundreds of local residents gathered in downtown Portland this past Saturday to protest the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, trade agreement. Oregon's Senator Ron Wyden apparently agreed to a backroom deal last week, allowing the fast-track bill to move forward in Congress. This bill will give President Obama unprecedented authority to negotiate the secretive trade agreement without needing the approval of Congress. Opponents of the TPP trade agreement point out that it will allow foreign corporations to have power to overturn U.S. laws, will increase the costs of life-saving medicine, and undermine a recent FCC rule protecting equal access to the Internet for everyone. KBOO's Paul Rowland was at the protest this weekend and brings us the sounds of the rally, beginning with Julie DeGraw of Food and Water Watch.
There is not an issue that you can care about as a human being on this planet that isn't impacted by bad trade policy. Whether you care about climate change or workers' rights, or whether you're concerned about food safety, if you're worried about anything that has to do with your clean, safe public water, if you are concerned about health care, if you are concerned about anything that really matters to people in this country and abroad, bad trade policy is bad for that issue. We have killed Fast Track before. We can kill it again. We need to work together and in solidarity to stop this from moving forward. And it's really disappointing to see our own Senator Wyden stand behind such atrocious, anti-democratic trade policies. Fast Track is the weakest thing that our Congress can possibly do, and this is why we're going to win. Food and Water Watch works in unity with a lot of organizations to make sure that we build up the people power in this country at the local, regional, and eventually national level so we can fix our food and water systems so that they work for people, not for corporations. Whether it's fighting for GMO labeling here in Oregon, or whether it's fighting for public water rights in Detroit, no matter what we do across the nation, we are building local democratic power to take our systems back for the people. All of those decisions, all of these wins that we have at the local and state level can be challenged by the TPP. This is not something we can stand by and let happen. If we want to build solutions in our own country for our own workers, if we want to have food systems that work for us and raise the standard internationally for workers' rights and for food safety and for everything that matters, if we want to actually get impact on climate change issues, we cannot allow bad trade policy to pass through the Congress. As I'm sure many of you are aware, a lot of the food safety standards in countries that would be part of this TPP deal are a lot lower than the standards we have here in the United States, which frankly aren't good enough and aren't even enforced most of the time. Right now, we already have food that comes into the United States that doesn't meet our own standards, and what these bad trade policies would do is even lower their standards further, making it easier for very bad and unsafe food to make it into our country so that that food ends up on our tables, and we don't even know about it. If you really care about the food you're feeding your families, and if you're really concerned about the quality of the work environment in these other countries where this food is being raised, where they're damaging their environment, and where people are being paid slave wages, if we really care about raising these standards, we cannot have free trade policy that's a race to the bottom. It is not acceptable. I just want to wrap up by saying once again that we have won on bad trade deals in the past. We have killed Fast Track in the past, and we absolutely can do it again. But it's only going to work if we all stand in solidarity to stop the Fast Track. Thank you so much.
Another speaker at this weekend's rally opposing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, was Barbara Dudley with the Oregon Working Families Party.
We are not, I hope, going to put up with this any longer. There were some other things that Wyden said that I thought I might just go over with you, just so you have answers when you're talking to your Uncle Henry about what's wrong with the TPP. First of all, Wyden says this one's better than the other deals because it protects free speech on the internet. It prohibits censorship on the internet. Now, I just want to say one thing. Remember that fight for net neutrality that Ron Wyden led just a few weeks ago? One of the things about the TPP, at least assuming it's like all the preceding trade agreements, which there's no doubt that it